Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, psychotherapist and a founder of the Awareness Integration Theory. And hello to Sean, our director in our studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I will share the tip of the week about our dualities in our decision-making, when we have to stay or leave or all of that. And then I will talk about how to handle your older parents when they are constantly fighting and arguing in the Ask Me segment. I am honored to bring you Dr. Don Meichenbaum. He's a distinguished professor emeritus from the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and he is the research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention in Miami, Florida. And we will be talking about hope, resilience, and the strength that we need to pull through at this time. I love to hear from you, so connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. I love to hear from you. But first, here's the tip of the week.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at fujian.com or amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Well, again, and this is the tip of the week. This week, I've been working with facing duality inside of us, which ends up paralyzing us toward any action. This has been very prevalent in the decision-making of whether someone wants to stay in their relationship or move on, whether one should stay at a job or leave it to another position, or if one should end a business partnership or not. So how do we make the best decision for us when each part of us wants and needs different outcomes? And what is the best decision? How do we come to an alignment and agreement between our separate parts? One of the biggest inner conflict is when the situation we're in is not ideal. If we stay in the relationship, we're not completely fulfilled. And if it just doesn't feel good enough, or it feels not enough. If we let go of the current relationship for the hope of the ideal future relationship, we might lose what we have right now. So at times we just cling to what we have with a sense of resignation, victimization, while we yearn for the ideal relationship to just fall into our lap with a guarantee of giving us all that we want. Well, some people wait passively while they look eagerly out there. Some become depressed since they lose hope for having the current relationship work and lose hope for ever getting what they want. And some continue the agony of vacillation between staying and leaving daily. So at times we enter a relationship, whether it's a romantic relationship, intimate relationship, or business or work relationship, with the most immediate need, such as I'm lonely, so I want to be in a relationship, or I need money, I need a job right now, this opportunity is just too good to pass up. And after fulfilling the existing need, other needs that are necessary to be fulfilled now show up, such as, I also want someone who is emotionally mature, or I need my autonomy, or other things that show up for us afterward. People try to fulfill their other needs within the same structure of the same relationship. However, the relationship might have never been set up to fulfill all other needs. Hence, the duality of fulfilling all needs simultaneously begins. So, what do we do? Let's take the following steps. One, observe your different needs. Observe them. And then two, write them down. What is your request? What is it that each part of you wants? Three, can you fulfill parts of your needs in this relationship? And what are they? Four, have you communicated to your partners about your needs? Or is it just that it's inside of you and you haven't shared anything? Five, is your partner capable of offering you a solution to fulfill the need within the structure of your current relationship or not? Six, is your need a current and appropriate adult need, or is it a childhood unfulfilled need, or is it an unrealistic need? Seven, write the pros and cons of staying in the relationship. Eight, write the pros and cons of leaving the relationship. Now, put two chairs in front of each other and assign staying to one chair and leaving to another. 10, sit on the staying chair position and talk about the rationale and all of your emotions for you and the need to stay. 11, sit on the leaving position chair, the other side, and talk about the rationale and all of your emotions and needs of why you need to leave. And then keep going back and forth until you come to some defined negotiation between the two parts. 13, then stand tall on top of both chairs and be a mediator between your two parts. 14, take your pros and cons sheet to five other people that you really trust and you like their opinion. Ask their opinion about it. 15, commit to a decision and an action. 16, commit to a date and a time if you choose to leave. And 17, commit to a shift of total attitude if you are going to stay, to accept what is, enjoy what is, and take it all fully. So for more observational and integration skills, go to my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life That You Want. Remember, in making decisions, listen and honor your needs from all parts of you. You are a whole person, and any missed decision that you make is going to affect all of you. Thank you.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hello again. This is Dr. Fujian in the Ask Me segment. Someone in my LinkedIn asked, how do I deal with my older parents who have a love and hate relationship? After so many years of marriage, they bicker and argue constantly, and I am tired of it. What do I do? So, many couples have gotten used to a particular way of communicating. And, you know, to others, it could be unhealthy, and even to them might be unhealthy, but it's a habitual construct that they've created for a type of a power struggle, or to be able to handle a power struggle, to keep their righteousness. And sometimes it's just habit. Sometimes It is actually the way two people have figured out how to be intimate in their conversation, which it may look like it's weird to you, but if they're not used to saying hi love, hi honey, and being able to give the words of intimacy, sometimes they've gotten used to just connecting with each other with bickering. And that bickering at the end, it just gives them a sense of connection and being together. Now, if they're getting angry at it and is really upsetting them, you got to realize they have figured this communication out for so long, and neither one of them either changed or with their own resilience, and they just survived it and somehow has become the way they are. And they might not really need to change that way of communicating. But if it's annoying to you, then it might be your issue that is being, you're being annoyed at that moment, or it's theirs. Another way of looking at it is also, would one or both of your elderly parents have gone through some sort of an organic chemical change and could be at this time suffering from one of the mental disorders, such as depression, anxiety, maybe it's the beginning of dementia or Alzheimer's or something that you might want to take them for treatment to their medical doctors, or even ask them to go to a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist and just make sure that they're doing well in all areas. If they're doing great in all areas of their life and it's just their relationship that is suffering, then it could be that it's just something that they've always done and they're continuing to do. But if they're also deteriorating in the other aspects of their life, in relationships with you or other people, in their suffering in kind of like the relationship that they have throughout the day with their daily function, then I really will ask you to take them for evaluation. If there's abuse involved, one is doing controlling over finances or verbal abuse or even physical abuse, you do need to get involved immediately and make sure that they're both safe. If there's no abuse and there's really no harm happening, then you might just want to step out and stay out. If there is a problem to be solved and they can't solve it because they just do the bickering and there are day-to-day matters that they actually have to take an action, maybe on those aspects you can get involved, find out what the problem is, bring a better and a healthier solution, problem-solving methods onto the table and support them in creating a better solution with whatever problem that is showing up for them in their life. If it's just the matter of their daily conversation that is just bickering, then my suggestion is butt out. Don't worry about it. Let them handle it the way they've been handling it so far. Sometimes it's just the personality glitch. Sometimes it's just, they annoy each other just the way they are, or they've gotten used to a particular way of communicating and that bickering continues. Now, there is a way that you could turn around and say, Mom and Dad, I want to, spend some time with you. And can you stop bickering while I'm here? And can we have a different type of a communication and kind of like avoid those conversations and just kind of like refer to something else? Remember, we do that a lot also with our young children. We distract them with some other conversation. So some of the times you could do that. And other times, distract yourself. Don't even let it be an issue for you. It's as if it is what it is. I've heard it all year, all of my life. And let them be and let them enjoy the way that they do it, although you don't enjoy it. So I know that for many years, our parents were disciplining us. And sometimes there becomes a year that we try to discipline them. It doesn't work out very well. They don't listen to us when we want to discipline them. So see how you can be useful. And if you think that you cannot be useful, then step out and let them be and accept them as who they are. They've handled it so far without you. They'll handle it again. Thank you.
Well,
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm so excited to have Dr. Don Meichenbaum with us again. He's a distinguished professor emeritus from the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and he is the research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention in Miami, Florida. He's one of the founders of cognitive behavioral therapy, and he was voted one of the 10 most influential psychotherapists of the 20th century by clinicians. He has received a Lifetime Achievement Award from Clinical Division of American Psychological Association and was honorary president of the Canadian Psychological Association. He has presented in all 50 U.S. states and internationally, and he has published extensively. His latest book is Treating Individuals with Addictive Disorders. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about this challenging topic of how to bolster resilience in the midst of a COVID-19 pandemic.
I always learn so much from you. I walk on every time we've been in the Evolution of Psychotherapy conferences. I walk everywhere you are, catching you from one place to another. And I really enjoy all these years of learning from you and every time you've come to my show. And I'm truly thankful for you doing that.
Yeah, well, that's gracious of you. This year at the Evolutions, you can just watch me on television, giving telehealth.
Yeah, I did most of them. Let us know a little bit about Melissa Institute, please.
Yeah, so it was noted at the outset that I was a clinical psychology professor at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. And that's about an hour and a half west of Toronto. And about 25 years ago, I took early retirement and I became research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention. Melissa was a young lady who grew up in Miami, Florida, and she was in her senior year at Washington University in St. Louis. And a tragic thing happened in that she was carjacked and brutally murdered. Now, when such a tragedy like that befalls an individual, their family, friends, and the community at large, one of the ways that people cope with trauma, and as you'll see, I'm heavily involved in that topic, is that people try to transform their pain into something good that would come of it. So Melissa's parents, Dr. Atman and his wife, Lynn, created an institute in her name designed to prevent violence. And what I would like to do is to encourage your listeners to kindly visit that website of the institute. Everything on it is available to you for free. So the website that one should go to is www and the word Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A Institute, all one word, .org. On it, you will find supplemental material to the discussion that we're having on how to bolster resilience in the midst of COVID-19 and a variety of ways to deal with the numerous stresses that people are undergoing. As we speak today, the United States is reaching the very sad statistic of having 500,000 people who have died. And this has resulted in tremendous losses of grief, prolonged and complicated grief or traumatic bereavement, even further complicated in that people have difficulty even memorializing and reaching and being with their loved one at the time of their death due to COVID. Well, one of the things that people may find on the Melissa Institute that we could comment on is various ways that people can cope with grief. There's a checklist on what people have found useful. One of the things to appreciate, even though there's losses due to death or losses due to insecurity or financial situations or natural disasters, think about what's going on in Texas as we speak right now with the absence of power and water and other kinds of stresses. It's overwhelming, but here's the major message that I want to convey. And that message is that while most people are impacted by some form of trauma or victimization or due to the long-term impact of the pandemic, in the long run, most people, some 75% of people, will go on and evidence resilience. That is the ability to bounce back, to deal with ongoing adversities. While in contrast, some 25% of individuals seem to get stuck in a variety of levels of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, violence, and the like. So I have devoted much of my research and clinical activity, and we can discuss this, on what distinguishes the 25% of people who get stuck versus the 75% of people who go on to evidence some kind of resilience, and in some small percentage, even evidence a kind of post-traumatic growth, that is the ability to appreciate life, to develop closer relationships, to find meaning-making activities in their form of religion or spirituality, to change life priorities. There's no magic bullet or particular procedures. We'll comment, hopefully, in this session on what are the building blocks of resilience so that your audience can take stock of what they already have within their repertoire and what they could add.
Right. One of the things that I have heard from you in your presentations have been that obviously we make up a lot of, our views, our perceptions, and the stories that we make up about what has happened and to us and how we are within that. So a kind of a vulnerable sense or a victim sense or the experience of powerlessness, but somehow we also generalize that concept of powerlessness and we blame the world for it or blame ourselves. And we kind of get stuck in that piece. And it appears that holds us in that trauma place.
Well, you're right. You know, each of us, both you and I and all of your audience, are not only Homo sapiens, but we're also Homo narrans. Mm-hmm. And what Homo narrans are storytellers. So we are all influenced by the stories we tell ourselves and we tell others and the stories we receive. It's not that bad things happen. Bad things happen to lots of people. And as we know now, in the course of the pandemic, it's a worldwide happening. So the key question of what distinguishes the 75% versus the 25% are in part the nature of the stories that they tell themselves, insofar as they see themselves as victims, as blameworthy, insofar as they continue to dwell upon and ruminate. Not only that, it's important, as we'll see, as a building block, is that we know that people who have had bad things happen or are living through bad things, if they keep it a secret, if they do not share it with others, if they do not find some way of transforming their pain into a kind of meaning-making activity, and not only the stories, but the nature of the coping tools that they have, you know, resilience kind of interesting, you know, because one of the things we know about resilience is that you could be both resilient and stressed at the same time, that these coexist, that it's not an either or proposition. And moreover, people could be resilient in one area of their life and not in other areas, or at one time and not at other times. Here's the key, however, is that resilience is not something special that a few people have. The people who've studied this, like Ann Mastin and others, have characterized resilience as an ordinary magic, that everybody has the potential of becoming more resilient in some form of their lives. You know, if you look upon the building blocks of resilience, if I could use that phrase, the one that we know that's most critical is the nature of the social supports that people have. That is the degree to which, not that they have a kind of physical distancing, but a social distancing, insofar as we can reach out even in this time of the pandemic, using some kind of chat line, telehealth, Zooming, what we're doing right now, and making a gift of our experience and well-being towards others. that's a key building block. We all need some kind of guardian angel of sorts. And that guardian angel, interestingly, may not only be a person, may be a sense of faith. You know, the major way that people cope with trauma and victimization in North America is to use some form of spirituality, some kind of meaning-making activity. I mean, just think for a moment of yourself being the parents of Melissa and getting that call in the middle of the night. What do you do with that kind of tragic loss, that emotional pain? You know, how do you transform that pain into a candle that you light to help others?
It's almost like going bigger than who we are. And part of that faith, whether someone is religious or not, is still stepping up and going bigger than what I'm capable of or can control. And it seems like that allows a little bit more of resilience and acceptance toward whatever is happening, as I'm hearing you.
Yeah, I mean, the glue that keeps people going, because, you know, the topic that we're talking about is a remarkable story of courage and grit, you know, and, you know, here's something, if you haven't done, I really recommend. The director and actor Ron Howard put together a documentary called Rebuilding Paradise. Paradise was a town in California that was destroyed by fires, and people died. There was all kinds of losses. And if you want some feeling for what resilience is all about, I encourage you to take a look at that documentary. It's on National Geographic, and you can just Google it and access this story, because it's a true measure of how a village and community bolsters resilience. It's the glue that keeps people going is a combination of empathy towards others, a sense of compassion towards others and oneself. To fall into that 25% of group, you really have to ruminate, tell your story, your coping strategies, whether it's using substances or engaging in self-injurious behavior.
One of the things that I'm also hearing from you is that if we go through a traumatic experience, whether it's a grief or a trauma that is happening to us, most people close up and they go in and stop connecting to the outside world. And what I'm hearing from you is what does work with resilience is actually opening up and connecting, being compassionate, yeah, empathizing toward yourself and others, and opening your hand toward others. It seems like it shifts you from, you know, holding back and avoidance of trauma into the parts of you who are resilient and accessing other people's resilience, which might become a synergy for you.
Yeah, that's well stated, you know, and I totally concur. And, the interesting thing is that it's not just opening up, it's transforming pain, you know. As I was mentioning, you know, social supports become an important element, you know, if you tell your story. And it doesn't have to only be with a mental health worker like yourself. It could be a significant other, and it may not even be words. You know, people have many ways of expressing feelings in terms of art expressive techniques. One of the most interesting ways is by means of journaling. You know, you don't know really what you think sometimes until you write it out. And there's a fair amount of research that supports the notion of that kind of sharing, putting out the nature of the story. Your story really needs to be filled with signs of hope. You know, one of the things we know in behavior change is that there's a thing called change talk. You know, the way the brain is built, there's a lower part of the brain called the amygdala and the hippocampus and so forth. And that's filled with emotions that are directly driven by the perception of threat in one form or another. It's a part of the brain that's tied to anxiety, depression, and fear that leads to avoidance. And one of the things we know is that that lower portion of the brain can actually, if I could use the word, hijack the frontal part of the brain. And the frontal part of your brain and of your listener's brain are the focus of executive functioning, okay? One of the things that becomes interesting is that the frontal lobe can figure out which stresses in your life are potentially changeable and those that are not, okay? All stresses are falling into one of those two categories or the combination therein. And therefore, the nature of resilience is having people match the nature of the coping technique to the demands of the stressor. So, for instance, if the stressor is potentially changeable, then you can actually notice, you can catch, you can plan, you can call upon your own resources, the supports of others. And therefore, you can try and take whatever that stressor is and break it down into its component parts and see if you cannot nurture hope, set meaningful, smart, specific, attainable goals to try and make some small inroad, lower your expectations and your demands on yourself and others. But there's another class of stressors that are not changeable, okay? And that's where people need to use emotionally coping techniques, palliative procedures, whether it's in the form of distraction, a form of mindfulness or relaxation, doing some kind of exercise, redirecting the feelings, using some form of meaning-making or social activities, making a gift of your experience towards others. You know, it's like the old serenity prayer that they use in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, God, give me the strength to change those things I could change, and the wisdom to know the difference between those things that are not changeable.
Yeah, to accept the ones that I can change, and then the wisdom to know the difference. Dr. Kimbaum, right. You talked about hope in the future. Can you share with us a little bit about when someone, for example, and I've heard a lot from people through the COVID, which they lost their lifelong partner and they were so attached, and they're in an age that they're not looking at, oh, well, you know, I'm going to I'll go through my grief and then I'm going to go find another partner. So to them, that part of them has completely, that part of their life has shut down and closed. Or people who were not ready necessarily for retirement or moving on, but they had to shut down their businesses and they can't get up and do it again. So this kind of, how can they go back to something and find some hope in something that is meaningful about their identity again in the future?
Well, let's take each of those in turn, if I may. So the loss of a loved one. So one of the things we know, and in fact, if your listener wishes, they can go on the Melissa Institute website and see a treatment manual on prolonged and complicated grief and traumatic bereavement that I use with clients. And in there, they'll find a checklist. One of the things that emerges in the area of grief is a procedure called restoring, retelling. So you don't really lose the relationship with the person who you loved and died with and lost and so forth. And, you know, that relationship needs to still strengthen your life as it exists now. So the question is, how do you cope with the one part of you that's dealing with the bereavement, but how do you then start to make small steps to regain your life? That is, what is it that your loved one who has died would want you to do at this point? You know, they even have a sense of sometimes carrying on a narrative with those we lost. You know, so the key element herein is to recognize that whatever grief, emotional pain that people are experiencing, that that's a normal and in many ways healthy reaction. It tells that person and others how close and endearing that relationship was. So it isn't a matter of turning on and off grief. It's how do you cope with grief? What is the story you tell yourself? What is the story that your deceased person would want you to tell yourself? And how do you develop the coping response? How do you deal with the meaning of that event? If you look at people who have lost loved ones, most people, as I know, are impacted, but only about 20 to 25% of people sort of get stuck. And there are ways that counselors who provide telehealth and others can help people get unstuck from that process. So grief, like anxiety, depression, are important emotions. They're messengers to us to take action. Okay. Your other part of your equation is similarly challenging, and that is COVID-19 and the pandemic has disrupted lifestyles. It has challenged people's livelihoods and supports. And the first thing that we know in bolstering resilience is the need for individuals to meet basic needs. That you can't engage in all of these other coping strategies of social supports and meaning making and spirituality if you don't have enough food or shelter, if you don't have the wherewithal to cope with your family supports and the like. So the first problem is how can not only individuals, but governments, community helping agencies and the like support individuals? You know, there are, for instance, peer groups. There's a work on teenagers who have been really distressed by the loss of being able to go back to school. In fact, the suicide rate among adolescents and others has increased substantially. Fortunately, there are websites. One for teenagers is called Reach Out, www.reachout, which is sort of peers talking to peers. Mm-hmm. The other is one that I have made available. During the course of the pandemic, I was approached by various hospitals to see if I could be of help to their frontline staff. And I had put together a book called Roadmap to Resilience. Mm-hmm. And what I ended up doing was to make that book available online for free. So your audience can go to the following website, which is Roadmap to Resilience, all one word connected, .wordpress, W-O-R-D, the wordpress.com. So it's Roadmap to Resilience, wordpress.com. And they could immediately access the entire book for free. This is sort of what the Melissa Institute does. I'm really proud to say that that book has now been downloaded by well over 26,000 people in 119 countries around the world. So I make that available to your listeners, and you can go through and look at any of the kinds of challenges that COVID has created in terms of anxiety, depression, anger, substance abuse. Not only that, weighs on ways you could build in your strength in positive emotions, not only emotion regulation, but positive emotions. You know, how can you use mindfulness, create a bucket list, use exercise? And if you click on any of those activities in the appendix, some guidance or advice will be forthcoming. And hopefully this will be of service. You know, if you're in this financial predicament, given the uncertainty and the like, then the question is, how have you as an individual coped in the past to build that business? How have you in the past have resources, either yourself or with others, to come as far as you can? Not only that, think of yourself as a member of a tribe. How have other people in your family, your ancestors, your particular ethnic or racial group cope with the variety of stresses? You know, if you look at the history of both the United States and mankind, they have overcome over the course of their development all kinds of traumatic events, from disease to natural disasters to wars and depression and the like. So knowing that we are going through a painful experience, but insofar as we can have realistic and optimistic, optimism is important to help build bold resilience. It's sort of the fuel that keeps us going. Remember, the name of the game is to not let the emotionality hijack your frontal lobe. How do you tailor your coping strategy to meet the demands? Now, hopefully that's getting close to your queries that you had about dealing with loss of an individual and loss of a lifestyle.
Yes, and how do you, I have so many questions that are coming up for me, but to go back to the same question, share with me, where do I go to find the hope in the future? Because you shared about how important it is. Is the hope in the faith, or is it the hope shows up also in when I evaluate how I have found hope before, or what was meaningful for me in my other areas of life, that I can capture that and bring it to the, you know, to the present moment and the future?
So first of all, it's important to have realistic hope, right? You know, there's no magic bullet that's going to take this away. It's going to take a lot of hard work, of safety, of wearing masks, of keeping social distancing, of in some sense, washing hands, all those kinds of Dr. Fauci kinds of guidances that we and the CDC. So one of the things we know about hope is that setting realistic goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely, that inherent in setting doable goals and taking small steps, that nurtures hope, okay? The second kind of thing is to realize that while trauma and loss can affect the brain, so can various positive emotions. So we know that, in fact, insofar as you can exercise, have hope, engage in social empathic responses with others, not only are you dealing and building up your emotions of hopefulness, you're actually changing the neurochemistry of your brain. You know, so that engaging in some kind of positive emotions. So, for example, if people go on the Melissa Institute, they will see that there's a link there on the face page called COVID-19. Okay. And if you go down and you click on that and you go into number 4, one of the things I've done is included humor as a way to bolster resilience. So I encourage folks to, when they get home, go to the Melissa Institute, go to COVID-19, click there, go to number 4, and you'll see the dozen best videos, YouTubes that I could find that are going to bolster your brain as well as nurture yourself via humor or some kind of positive emotion. It's hard to permit yourself to engage in experiencing some positive emotion when there's so much loss in many different areas in one's life. So how does one find hope? By having meaningful, doable goals. How does one find hope? By opening up your experience, letting yourself experience some kind of positive emotions. How do you find hope? Is you recognize that you can control the emotional regulation of negative emotions that's going to detract from hope. How do you find hope is that you need to find hopeful others. Okay. And therefore, you know, possibly with the vaccines that are forthcoming, there will be some positive results as an outgrowth of this COVID. Maybe this COVID will, in some sense, help our appreciate our common humanity around the world. Maybe the level of violence or empathy might increase as a result of this. People have indicated that as a result of COVID, they don't mind going to conferences and work from their home. Some people have even said that they've had an opportunity, even though it's challenging, to spend more time with their kids and appreciate the challenges that teachers have. You know, every glass is half full or it's half empty. Remember, everyone is a homo narin. We are a storyteller. And the stories we tell ourselves about COVID-19 and the pandemic, the stories that we tell others. In fact, you can go on the Melissa Institute, and we've just put there a whole list on how to talk to kids about the pandemic, how to boast of their resilience. So insofar as you're trying to help others in an empathic way, who else are you helping but yourself?
Yes. There's also
no shame, last point, to reach out to a counselor of one form or another in order to help them as well as yourself.
You have worked a lot with also with addiction. And one of the things that are happening right now, and you mentioned it also, is the highest level of suicide for teenagers, but also whether it's a suicide via using drugs or it is an overdose. Dr. Meghan, I can tell you within the past month, I have been privy to families who have lost their teenagers and young adults to accidental. So I can't really necessarily call it a proactive suicide attempt, but mostly accidental overdoses. And obviously, the emotion that goes through with everyone who is the family members, the guilt, the blame, everything that is going through. What are your thoughts, and what can you share? And is there a way that obviously parents or people or friends could be monitoring or watching, listening, seeing, feeling? And is there anything they can do? And then if that didn't work out, how can they go through their grief and come back to their resilience of what's going on?
Well, you mentioned at the outset that I had recently published a book on treating individuals with addictive disorders that Rutledge puts out. So I'll sample from that book, if I may, in answering your question. The first is there's increasing evidence that substance abuse overdoses, especially opioids, is significantly increasing. And it's increasing for a variety of reasons that I'll just tick off. One is that there's a greater likelihood of overdoses when people are in isolation as compared to overdosing on opioids when there are others who may have Narcan or other kinds of things or call 911 if they see that kind of symptomatic behavior. There's also less likelihood of having access to your favorite drug or treatment center. So AA meetings, Narcotics Anonymous, and so forth are much more challenging in terms of not having access to meetings and it all having to be on telehealth. And high-risk people often don't have that kind of computer technology. So services that are designed to help people, you know, when it comes to teenagers, I'm going to once again direct people to this website, reachout.com, which is a peer-to-peer. So peers can actually go on and help other peers and hear the nature of their problems. For parents, there's always a need to check in with and access and monitor as in a kind of friendly fashion as possible what's going on with their teenagers, so that you can in some sense look for warning signs, and once again, if you go to the Melissa Institute, I have written and used various treatment manuals on adolescent depression and suicide that give sort of all the warning signs that clinicians, as well as parents, as well as peers are often more effective than parents in knowing which of their fellow adolescents are undergoing some kind of distress. In fact, you know, there's a fair amount of work on the Melissa Institute on bystander interventions, you know, so insofar as we can open up the door whereby people feel that if they see a friend in need of help, they could reach out. One of the things that becomes important is that parents themselves can also act as problematic models. You know, so insofar as parents are not coping or overdosing on substances of one form or another, it sort of implicitly gives permission for adolescents to cope in a similar kind of fashion. There is increasing data that especially adolescents in high achieving schools are under tremendous stress and expectations. So therefore, insofar as there are interventions that people can use with adolescents. In fact, I'm giving a Zoom presentation on this Friday for 3 hours on exactly how to bolster resilience in adolescents. And people can tune into that if they are so disposed by going online and on the Melissa Institute and seeing how they could register for that kind of course. You know, so insofar as parents could reduce some of the demands, expectations. So it's not only bad enough that peers have to deal with a violation of all that they expected in terms of prom, applying to colleges, sports events, social relationships of being isolated, and then the demands of school, right, in terms of the high challenges of trying to keep up. Understanding that the priority now is how to help people get through COVID, they'll be able to catch up on the academic down the road. Teachers play a critical role in schools insofar as they could provide individual supports and tutoring to adolescents, one-on-one or one-on small groups. One cannot overestimate the significance of having that kind of social contact and being enough to veer someone from a kind of depressogenic suicidal ideational framework. You know, I guess the recognition that there's increasing challenges and being supportive of adolescents of trying to help them find some activity that gives them meaning in spite of that social isolation becomes really critical.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you so much for the time you're allowing for us. So in a minute or so, if there's anything that we haven't touched upon and you really want our audience to know, what would it be?
We're all capable of resilience. And we have resources within ourselves, within our family, within our community that we can access. We're not alone. No man is an island. And I wish all of your audiences the best of health. The best message is keep safe. Do what's necessary for you and your family at this point in time.
And to ask, seek out, get information. And I think that's one of the biggest things that you have always offered the mental health community and to the audience through the Melissa Institute and everything that you're doing and offering online is for people to gain systematically in how to put themselves into growth, resilience, hope, And I thank you from the community of mental health and psychotherapy. I truly thank you for what you're doing. And I thank you.
Thank you. Everyone, and thanks for the opportunity to share this message.
Absolutely. So everyone, Dr. Donald Meichenbaum, please go to melissainstitute.com. If you're watching us,
.org.
I'm sorry. If you're watching us, you will see it under our name, Melissa Institute, two S, melissainstitute.org. And also roadmaptoresilience.wordpress.com. And you will have a lot of amazing information. One of the things that I've always admired about your books, and I think I have all of them, is that you come up with so many amazing questions for people that would open up the answers from within. But the series of the questions, the detailed questions, they're crisp. In how to open up someone to ponder and bring up their best and the truth from inside and bring it up and be aware of it. So that's one of your most amazing gifts that you have.
Thank you.
And for everyone who have been with us, thank you so much for listening with your heart. And create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.